there are human beings out here who want to die so bad. No one wants to talk about the reasons why. It's just shut right out. And what a beautiful option. I can take this pill. If I want to kill myself, no one's going to know that it was suicide.
Hey there, my name is Sean, and this is Suicide Noted. On this podcast, I can't even remember my intro. This right here. Hey there, my name is Sean, and this is Suicide Noted. On this podcast, I talk with suicide attempt survivors so that we can hear their stories. Every year around the world, millions of people try to take their own lives, and we almost never talk about it. We certainly don't talk about it enough. When we do talk about it, many of us, including me, we're not very good at it. So one of my goals with this podcast is to have more conversations and hopefully better conversations with attempt survivors, in large part to help more people in more places hopefully feel a little less shitty and a little less alone. Now, if you are a suicide attempt survivor and you'd like to talk, please reach out. Hello at suicidenoted.com on Facebook or X at suicidenoted. I want to apologize because, as you may have noticed, today's episode was a little delayed. I won't get into all the reasons why, but I'm glad I'm able to get it out to you on Mondays, as I always try to do. Also, we are having a members meeting in the next couple of weeks, and we will be discussing a topic or an idea or something important. And those recordings, at some point sooner than later, will be special episodes. So if you want to be a part of that, have that conversation, and have your voice and your thoughts and your ideas aired out to the world, I encourage you to visit the link in the show notes where you can find information about that membership and all kinds of cool stuff. Finally, we are talking about suicide on this podcast, and I don't hold back, so please take that into account before you listen or as you listen. But I do hope you listen, because there is so much to learn. Today, I am talking with Angela. Angela lives in Ontario, Canada, and she is a suicide attempt survivor. Hey, Angela.
Hi.
So, you have been listening to some of the Suicide Noted podcasts, yeah?
Yeah, I've been listening to them. And I'm just wowed at it.
Tell me how amazing I am, please.
Well, there's just not many people who even care to speak about it. It's literally that one fact. You know, you're willing to speak about it, and that makes you amazing. It needs to be looked at a lot harder than it is.
How old or young are you, Angela?
I'm 47 years old.
Angela, in her 40s, in Ontario. Thank you for being here. Thank you for talking with me. I appreciate it. Now, your video is off. I'm going to guess that you are... I think you're in an attic.
No, I'm out in my truck in the driveway.
Now, this wasn't intended. It wasn't the plan, but we do have another guest in a car or truck.
I thought, should I go into town and sit in the parking lot of the Tim Hortons and make sure I'm, you know, and I thought, no, I don't want to be sitting there talking, you know, it's not the environment I want to be in, but it's okay. I'm still in grass and trees and loveliness. So I'm good.
I know how you found this in me, but I'm wondering why it is that at some point, I'm imagining in the past few months, you were nosing around online or on a podcast platform, and I'm pretty sure you put the word suicide in there. So tell me about that, please.
Well, it wasn't suicide, but I was looking up the effects of loneliness in your TED Talk. Immediately underneath the video was the words in the little picture saying suicide noted, and then underneath saying suicide attempted survivor. And I went, what? And right. I didn't listen to the TED Talk. I immediately tapped on that. And I was like, this is almost unbelievable. Is this, you know, like right away? I was like, what? That's a very clever title. Also, I was like, this is nice. You know, like it's the acknowledgement of it in public right there on YouTube. It's like, whoa, you know, it's hard to find other human beings who will even just say, yeah, oh, wow, I attempted too. And this is what's happening with me, and have just conversation.
Angela, you know, I have a gift for memoir titles, right? You can't be that surprised that the title of my podcast is decent too. I mean,
simple and brilliant.
Simple and brilliant. Love it. Hey, how did you find me or this podcast?
I found this number one Suicide Noted episode, and it was just a screen and talking, and I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. And I was just hooked. Yeah, immediately I was like, okay, wait a minute. This isn't anything that I even thought it could be. Like, this guy knows how to just let someone tell their story. Like, wow, I've been in all different places when it comes to it, and I need to share my story.
Okay.
So cool. I better reach out to this guy and say, man, hey, we got to do this.
And despite the Wi-Fi issues, we're making it happen. Are you wearing your seatbelt?
No way, man.
Buckle up, Angela, because we're just getting rolling here. You might want to put it on because this baby's going to get real, real good. I've never said that before. All right. So you are, let's just dive right in, Angela. Let's not fuck around here. How many suicide attempts do you have?
I have one suicide attempt myself. Somewhere around end of 2001, early 2002, somewhere in there.
So literally half your life ago, almost.
Yeah.
Leading up to that moment in which you attempted to take your life, or from that moment when you attempted to take your life, right? So we're covering decades. Did you or do you regularly think about ending your life?
So yeah, between the ages of 13 and 44. 42 at least, I thought about it continuously. It was always in my subconscious mind. It was never gone. And there would be very creative ways of thinking to kill myself. Ridiculous, in fact.
Very creative and ridiculous probably isn't the standard or common ways, right? So would you share one or two? Do you recall? Because I'm weird.
What can I do with this paperclip right now to end my life swiftly and possibly without too much pain? Is there something I could do? Is there somewhere in my eyeball I could stick it? My brain would continually be working on, I need to kill myself now, as a background program running while I was doing my day.
Okay.
Yeah.
So up until 13, not so much. And then the last, I guess, few years, not so much or not as often.
Correct. Everything has changed for the last few years. I'm going to say that I'm lucky to have experienced direct reasons that I can look back on to know exactly why I wanted to kill myself.
So if I asked you the question, and I probably will, like, what led you to try to end your life? You would have an answer.
Can I speak about homicidal thoughts? I had a specific incident happen where my own father attempted to strangle me to death. Because of that incident and our family policy to not speak about anything in our home, and the bruises that were left had me go to school the next day and speak to counselors about it. They brought in the police. They brought in the Family and Children's Services of the area. They interviewed me. They interviewed my mother. They interviewed my father. And then they kindly came and told me I was going to go home in my mother's car, but to the family home. And I stated there was no way I was going home. I begged them, this was at 13 years of age, to not let me go home. He was going to kill me, and I was certain of it. That's a pretty direct understanding of, like, in hindsight, I can understand why after that point I had some issues. When it came to, you know, they call them father issues, but yeah. So what happened after that was I had to go home with my parent, and I was assured by the police and Family and Children's Services that nothing bad would happen to me, that it was an incident that was not going to occur again, and he would never touch me at all ever again. And I was not convinced of that. That's where I would say I did experience, it was hard to deal with until I understood it. But in hindsight, I realized that I felt I needed to take his life. So what I did was, for the next 7 nights in a row, I don't know if you know the steak knives with the plastic handles, I had one of those in my hand, and I would creep into my parents' room and stand there over my father and think, can I stab him? Can I cut him somewhere he bleeds enough that he can die quickly enough that no one really has to suffer too bad, but that he's gone.
Angela, now I want to let everyone else who's listening to this, y'all need to put on your seatbelts. I hate that you had to go through that, but I love the honesty. You want to talk about things people don't talk about, Angela? They don't talk about suicide. They certainly don't talk about homicidal thoughts. Not often. You wanting to literally kill your father. So seven straight days with a knife. So I have this image where you are actually in the room while they sleep, and you're kind of like, what, going through the motions, thinking just where, when, how?
I'm standing there absolutely motionless, trying to gather the will to do it. I'm telling myself, your sister is going to be safe. Your brother is going to be safe. Your mother is going to be safe if you get rid of this threat. My mind is going continuously. The threat must be eliminated, right? Because it was such a trauma, what had happened the night before. So the only thing that kept me from attempting to do anything to him with that serrated little steak knife was the fact that my mother was laying right there. And I did not want her to experience anything bad. I just didn't want her experiencing. I thought all I could think of is, but if I do it, she's going to be experiencing something bad. I don't want her to experience something bad.
They're both alive?
Yes. After that, the next year was absolute hell in our household. If it was hell before, it was some sublayer of hell now. What I didn't understand was how bad certain mental illnesses can be and how there's no help for certain people with certain mental illnesses. So when you have a father like mine, who you believe is a normal, everyday human being, but can have fits of rage and other things. I mean, there's so many other issues that happen that I don't even know how to explain them. What I came to understand later, he must have been suffering from psychopathy and or narcissistic personality disorder or some other thing, including both of those things. But there's no way to know any of those things when you're a child or when someone's really putting on the show to the whole world of a saint. No one believed my story also, thinking I couldn't kill him and he was going to kill me and having a horrible home life then. My mother decided he was going to leave. There were attempts by him to be a normal person. I don't even know how to explain it. He kept changing himself and saying, is this better? Is this better? Is this better? And every time it was bad. It was just really bad. And it was like, we don't know what you're trying to do, but we don't want to be a part of it anymore, was kind of the deal. He just pointed it all my direction. It was your fault for telling. Everything's your fault for telling, and that's great. So my parents ultimately split, and my younger brother, who was 8 or 9 at the time, was left with my father. My father said, you're not going with her, you're staying with me, and the girls are going with the mother, and that's the way it's supposed to be. So we left with our mother, me and my sister, and my brother stayed with my father. My mother changed after that, because little did we know, she had been fighting for custody of my brother and not getting anywhere. And she started having an alcohol issue for a little bit, but she was still functional, but she was a different mother. Then when my brother did finally come to visit, we could see there he was not the same person. And as a very young boy, I think he was about almost 10 at that point, we finally got a visitation. And he came into the middle of the living room, sat down cross-legged and said, you girls are all whores. You've been spreading your legs to all the men in Southern Ontario, and I'm not moving or saying anything more till my dad comes and gets me. And my mother ran off. My sister ran off. She was like, I don't know, 11, 12 tops. I mean, she didn't even understand what he was saying. Literally, he got up and walked out the door, and my father was still down the road, and he left.
Your father was obviously telling this to your brother. And your brother at 10 years old is just regurgitating that information back to you that you are quote unquote whores.
Yeah.
At what age does your brother take his own life?
31.
About 20 years after that.
He did really become an amazing human being for what he went through. I mean, to be able, he actually held himself together way better than you could imagine as a teenager. And as a young man in his 20s, I would have never have believed some of the things he ended up telling me about what he experienced with my father afterward. I was shocked. I was just really, really shocked at how well He presented himself with the amount of abuse, because then he was dealing also with the abandonment of my mother, right? Just as what has happened, like there was no way around that. Yeah, he would have had abandonment issues as well as the trauma issues from my father, right?
Mm-hmm. At 13, you start to think this way, because that's the age you said it started. And it's not another 10 plus years that you try.
I realize I need to maybe move out of the house myself. I need to do something. I end up running away and going to a girlfriend's house for a couple weeks. But Christmas is coming and they say, listen, you just can't be here. You got to go back home. And I end up back home. And that's when my mother leaves. I get through high school pretty quickly. I don't want to be there. And I end up getting a full-time job at 17 and a half. And I have a boyfriend. And that's great. As long as I could keep the program of living, the make your money, do your job, la, 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 as long as I can keep that up. And I just don't act on all of the ways I want to kill myself. I figure I'm golden. I'm golden forever. But I didn't realize that I was slowly becoming an alcoholic. There was the underlying self-hatred that stayed, right? So not only did no one want to listen to me, did no one believe that he tried to take my life, even though the reason why the counselor was there, because the bruises were there, like the evidence was there, but no one wanted to listen to it or wanted to do anything about it in my eyes. And I couldn't eliminate the threat. So it was a state of constant fear. When before, with my father would put me in duressful states. It was always about your grades. Mm-hmm. And he had a rubber mallet that he had written my name on in white out, because the mallet is black. And he would bring it to the kitchen table when the report card came. And he said, every bad grade, you're going to get a knock in the head with the rubber mallet. And every time there was a test date, say, remember the rubber mallet. Unfortunately, when you're stuck in duress, when you're fearful of the grade you're going to get, you really can't concentrate on a test. So I was pretty poor in school, and I was just continually told I was going to get hit with the mallet, but never got hit with the mallet. But the fear was enough to traumatize me as a young child, right?
Yeah.
So then I move out. I have my own place. I get married and I continue on with this world of, you know, do these steps and this is what life is. I did all the steps. I tried a million and one jobs. You know, I tried to fill that hole, that void hole of pain with everything I could, anything I could. Now, not alcohol and cigarettes, but I never really touched anything else except for marijuana when I was 25.
At some point in that general time frame, your daily ideations go to the next level, so to speak, and you try. So let's just go to that day in as much as you can recall. Like, what was there something different about that day, or was it more of just a piling up and that's when things just broke?
It was exactly that. 100%. I have tried every type of relationship with a man. I have tried every type of job out there that I want to do, that I think I can do. I have tried everything that our world that I thought said I could try to do. And I'm not happy. I don't want to be here. What's the point of this? Why am I in so much internal agony? And I have no answers and there's no one to help. I had just been through a breakup. So there was definitely the abandonment issue, because all I was thinking was, okay, that's the last one. And there's not going to be any more guys. I was like literally saying, that's it. I'm abandoning myself from relationships. Like, I'm just done. And then I just realized, you know what? I don't have any more energy to keep doing this to figure out what's going to be next. Like, I just keep hoping for something and it's not there. Where is it? What is it? I don't know what it is. And something just said, well, you've lost your will. And I just was like, yeah, I've lost my will to live.
Right. Isn't that arguably, I don't want to simplify any of this, but that's kind of what just about every guest has in common here.
Yeah, I was just like,
What happens before you attempt to take your life, you have probably lost your will to live. They just have to go hand in hand, I think. Mm-hmm. Or there might be people, certainly, who want to live, but perhaps circumstantially, there's no way out.
But it's still, you can, maybe it's semantics, but all right. So what do you do that day?
I wrote my note. I wrote my note to my brother because he lived with me at the time. And I wrote the note saying, I'm sorry. I've lost my will to live. I'm done. Maybe a couple of lines saying sorry to him, you know, that I was going, but I don't have any more left in me, basic. I've lost my will. I think I've lost my will to live. And I gathered my pills that I thought would gently ease me to sleep and off to death and never to see this world again. And I really believed that. And I laid down on my couch after swallowing them. And I said, this is it. It's good. I don't have to deal with any more pain.
Do you remember what you were thinking, if anything else, in those moments?
It's going to be over.
Relief/anticipation, it almost sounds like.
Yes. I did not want to struggle anymore. My body started literally burning from the inside out. My bones felt like they were on fire. Everything started hurting in a way I have never experienced before. And I grit through it for a bit. I clenched my fists and I said, nope, that's fine. And I said, I've seen enough torture movies. This pain is going to knock me out too. Fine. That's fine. If this is it, then that's fine. And I tried and I tried and it seemed like forever, but it must not have been that long until I was wide awake and running around in screaming pain, unable to know what to do next. And I picked up the phone and dialed 911. I was in a big town. They were there in moments. It was not long. By the time I could unlock the door and the operator was saying, stay on the line, I was passing out in front of a paramedic. I was still thinking, good, I'm dying. They can't revive me. They still got to get me. They got to get me somewhere. I'm dying in my doorway right here. Oh, beautiful. You know, at least I'll already be at the hospital in the wagon. My brother won't have to find my body. And off I went. But I woke up.
Spoiler, every single person I talked to, Angela, we know it didn't work.
No, it did not. I was so naive. I mean, wow. I really did think, you know, I mean, it was 150, 199% going to work. Like, there's just no way it wouldn't. Yeah, no, I woke up and I basically just said, you know, first they had the catheter in, they had to pull out. You know, only once I was awake, the charcoal drink still in the mouth and whatnot, and the psychiatrist at the bedside. And they basically just said, we got someone here to come pick you up. What happened? And I said, oh, man, I just had a breakup and I was just feeling really lonely for a moment. I just took some pills. I'm so sorry, man. Like, I feel horrible. Meanwhile, I'm saying, God damn, why did I wake up? Why am I here? I don't want to tell this guy this and get him off my back.
Right. So you could have said, or one could have said, like, I am really doing bad. I did not want to live. I don't think I want to live. Why didn't you take that route?
Because I had dealt with so many other people not listening to me, not caring, exposing myself to them and what was going on and them not having any answers or help for me.
Might say, like, why keep being so open and honest, right? Sure.
I assumed immediately that with what I had already experienced with the health community and everything, even just in the public school, was that no one's going to have any help for you. They're going to listen to what you say. They're going to, like, write it down somewhere, but they're not actually going to have any help for you. You're still stuck in the same position.
Mm.
So just keep your mouth shut until you figure something else out, until you can figure it out. There's no one else that's going to figure it out for you because they obviously don't know, or they would already have help. Yeah, the way I looked at it was if this psychiatrist actually had help and I was telling them on the 911 call that I was trying to kill myself, like, you know, if this psychiatrist had some type of help when he's sitting there at my bedside, he'd be offering it. He wouldn't be asking me why. He wouldn't be. He'd be saying, hey, you tried to kill yourself. We have this help for you. Here it is. Not, oh, okay. Yeah. You can slough it off. Yeah. Oh no. It was just this thing, you know, it was just something that happened. Well, you know, if it's just something that happens to people out of nowhere, you know, how can it ever be help?
You were put in a position to try to figure it out by yourself. And from what you shared earlier, you did kind of figure it out. It just took you about 20 more years.
Yeah. Well, it took other situations like my brother's suicide. I don't know. I put me into like full force and then stop type of motion. It was like, okay, he successfully killed himself. I can successfully kill myself. I had hope again. So after the first attempt, I had no hope that I could kill myself. I wasn't even going to try. But that's when the funny thoughts of how could I, and in hopes that possibly through all of that overstimulated thought and overthinking, I could come up with a way to die. Maybe there'd be this way. For sure, no doubt, I was going to go. And it gave me time.
You didn't try again.
But I didn't want to. No, there was no way I was going to try again. But that put me in a much worse psychological state. It caused me to have, really bad depression and a lot of hateful feelings, a lot of anger and hate that I couldn't reconcile with. It was very difficult because you point at others and then you point at yourselves and then you point at others and then you point at yourself and then you're just stuck in that. It's like almost a fight within yourself. You don't know what to do and you don't think there's anyone who can help you because you feel 100% alone. And even though sometimes you're surrounded by a bunch of people, all people who say they love you, and you're like, no, man, it's just not there.
I know that you had a challenging, and I'm using my own words, you're like, rather challenging upbringing. Try in your 20s, your brother passes away from suicide in your and his 30s, and in your 40s, something changes.
What happens is I'm bouncing between I have to kill myself and I can, because once my brother committed suicide, so I'm dealing with grief, right? I'm dealing with his loss. And I know everything he went through, and I realize it is this past of abuse that caused it. And I need to expose this if I stay living. So I've got these two opposites. Yes, you can kill yourself. Go and just do it. Get it over with and done. Or expose this. Continue to speak up about why no one's helping anyone who thinks they're actually living with a narcissist, have a parent who is a narcissist and or a psychopath, people who are doing weird and strange things in the household that might not be considered abuse offhand, but are not good. And that can really, really hurt a child's mental state. I try and get involved in personal situations like this and help people who can see this and aren't getting any help. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of children in homes with parents who are not properly taking care of those children and are put through all of the system's paces and nothing has happened. The children still suffer the exact same consequences they would have either way.
I want to better understand how you got from thinking about ending your life regularly to not.
As soon as I started piecing together that and seeing that no one else was really going there, mm-hmm. no one else wants to go there, and not especially psychologists and psychiatrists, I started contacting many of them after my brother passed and said, listen, this is what's going on. I need your help. I want help. I don't particularly want to die. I'd rather expose this, but I'm not getting any help. Like, I don't want to have to go and learn psychology. Like, I don't want to, go for 15 more years worth of schooling to know what you do. Can I just find someone who can help me that has letters behind their name so other people listen to them? And I got nowhere. And that really put me down. I was like, what do you mean? There's these people out there who can really seriously hurt children, and they get away with it still to this day. There's no help for them or the children or the people who are with those people, unless those people who have this problem come to you and say, I'm a psychopath, or I think I have a problem. Can you diagnose me? And their diagnosis includes the fact that they will never go to anyone and ask for help because they don't think they need it. Uh-oh. At that point, I decided I'm killing myself. This is too much. I can't wrap my head around this. I'm done. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do what my brother did. I'm going to do exactly what my brother did. And I'm going to explain why, because there is no help. Mm-hmm. There's just no help when everyone says they're helping. It'd be fine if they said, I can't help you. Okay, then we're getting somewhere. But when they say, I can help you,
and they can't. So I said to myself, I'm going to go online for the rest of the day. I'm going to give myself 24 hours of searching online for information that's going to keep me wanting to be here. And I found it within about 3 hours. I don't know why or how, but I found the information about the victim abuse cycle. I found information about what thoughts, emotions, and actions are. Like just knowing, oh, wait, a thought is something going on in my head. I can somehow control that. When someone on the internet said that you can control your thought, it blew my mind. I was like, what do you mean I can control that? I can control that somehow? Wait a minute. This doesn't make sense. And it took a long time, but that spark of I can figure this out. I'd say I was actually about 29. It was about a little over a year, maybe 40, when I made that decision that day.
Okay.
I'd been struggling back and forth so hard. And I made the decision, that's it. You're killing yourself if you don't find the information. And then it seems like the information has continued to come. So I believe now in cause and effect. I feel that that's exactly what's going on. It's like the mechanism of cause and effect is continuously feeding me the information I need to keep going so that I never, ever once have to think about not being here. I wouldn't even know where to begin. I can call it some sort of divinity, but I have to say the only thing I know is I have a life force inside me. When I'm dead, that life force is gone. And whatever is in that life force, it's what's helping me.
Okay.
I've tried to look into religions. I've tried to look into all sorts of sciences. And it's just like, you know what? All I need to know is that I'm alive. All I need to know is that I think, I have emotions about my thoughts, and I can take actions. I've bare minimumed it. I went down to the basics because I realized the life that I grew up in was nothing that was stable. There was no foundation there. And that's why I had that massive hole of pain. There was nothing there. I had nothing to hold on to. I was in a hole with no rope to climb out. There was just nothing there. I start going through all of my childhood experiences and realizing, okay, I might feel this way because of that. And I might feel this way because of that. So I don't need to feel those things. I don't need to think those things. I don't need to have any of those types of thoughts anymore.
But recently you put in loneliness somewhere to find something and eventually found this podcast.
Yeah. When I was with partners who were narcissistic and with my father who is narcissistic, there is a, I don't know what, it's like a worse loneliness than loneliness. When you are free of those people being around you, you aren't lonely anymore, even if you are alone.
Well, you aren't.
No, I wasn't. Anyways, that's what I experienced. I experienced that this aching loneliness that I was feeling had something to do with having many of these people in my life and feeling, because there's a lot of devaluation, right?
Yeah.
That comes from those people. And then if you already feel low about yourself, you sometimes only have to be around them to feel it. Especially if you have some empathetic, all of a sudden you think you're alone and you don't understand why this aching loneliness, but some of it lifts when you remove some of these people from your day to day. If you can,
If you can. Right. Loneliness is such an interesting and I think often really misunderstood idea or experience. So as we speak right now, you don't want to end your life.
Correct.
You are lonely.
No.
You're not lonely. Okay. I was going to say good, but I tend to hesitate to say anything like that, good or bad, right? Just it is what it is. Okay. Yeah. I have a few questions that may seem they're related, but they're sort of a bit of a pachinko bouncing around thing. Okay. Here we go. How many people know that we're talking?
Quite a few. Everyone I've personally spoke to that I have a personal connection with in the last couple of weeks since I sent you the email, I've said, hey, you know about this podcast? Whether or not any of them are even interested in listening to it or anything, that's their deal. When I find something new and I speak to people, that's how I kind of even judge, you know, is this person going to be a closer friend or are they going to pull away?
Did you keep the note?
It wasn't there when I got home.
Oh, okay. Somebody got rid of it.
Yeah, that would have been my brother. Yeah. And he came and picked me up from the hospital.
He figured out over time that some of the stuff your father was telling him was not true.
Yes. In hindsight, just to see how he even went to my mother later and said, you know, I held grudge against you for a long time because I thought this and I thought that and I thought this about you. But I totally forgive you for anything that you might have done. And, you know, I love you and whatnot. And they had an exchange where they were reunited as an adult a young man. He reconciled with mom and they became whatever an adult son and mother would be without that middle part.
I bet your mom liked that day when he finally was able to reconnect with her.
Well, yeah, he has two children and a widow, and my mother is a big part of their lives. So she's, you know, she has that, which is really, really good.
Have you ever spent time in a mental health facility?
No. 2003, I guess a year after my attempt, I physically couldn't stop crying for a week. I went on medical leave from my job. I literally could not understand why I was physically crying and not feeling sad at all. Of course, I still was ideating behind it all, but feeling sad? No, I'm going through my motions. I'm going through my day. There isn't something happening that I should be sad about, is what my logic mind was, or what I was saying to myself. I went to my doctor. They set me up with a psychiatrist, and I started telling the incidents to the psychiatrist. And I went on a lot of medications, and I had a lot of diagnoses. So it was first acute depression and anxiety. Even though I told him I felt fine, I just couldn't stop crying. And then after telling my story and starting on the first antidepressant drugs, there was just, you know, oh, okay, so you have PTSD. All right. And oh, okay, so you have schizoaffective disorder. Well, it makes sense that you wouldn't trust people if you couldn't trust them. Yeah, I guess so. Okay, so yeah, so this is a normal thing. These are all normal reactions to the life you've had. So here's a whole bunch of chemicals to fix that for you. You're going to be all right. Head on home. You know, you'll be back to work in no time. Meanwhile, I have the employment insurance telling me you're on medical and you can get a job. You need to get a job. You have to get a job right now. And I'm like, no. I'm still having issues. I'm testing out all these medicines on myself and they're not doing good. I'm feeling really bad. I'm feeling way worse than I could have felt to be crying all that much, but I wasn't feeling bad when I was crying. So now I'm feeling really bad. And everyone says, oh, you look so much better. So I'm not liking this. Come the third pill, I think it was, that I ended up taking, I started gaining weight so quickly. I couldn't carry myself anymore. And that was, I think I gained 30 pounds in 20 days. And I called up the psychiatrist and I said, I'm not taking this anymore. There's an issue. Oh, you got to give it a couple months. I said, there's no way. There's no way I'm giving this a couple months. So I stopped that one immediately. But unfortunately, I still was on this regimen of pills that I did not like. And they were just telling me, you got to keep on them. You can't just start something and stop them. So I tried that. After about 3 years of trying and going up and up and up on doses of all of these medicines, I was done.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's enough. I'm going to leave the city. I'm just going to say, I don't want to do this anymore. And I'm going to leave the city. And I got in my minivan with my boyfriend and my two dogs and my cat. And we moved all the way up north here in Northern Ontario. We lived out of the van in the winter time. I don't know, a month or two until we found an apartment, which there weren't many of in the little northern town we were hanging out around. Started to try and take myself off of antidepressants and antipsychotics. And it was not fun.
Did you get a diagnosis that you ever thought was accurate?
Yeah, I'm sure I had PTSD. And I'm sure, you know, the schizoaffective portion of the understanding that, yeah, you don't trust people. Because when I put my trust in them, there was nothing back. It makes sense to me. Then is that a mental condition or is that a condition of what I went?
Right.
So if I went through that and you're telling me that this is a mental illness, this doesn't measure up. That means that society and how we run and what goes on in it is causing in part the human beings to be ill.
Totally.
How can I rectify this if it's partially our societal structure.
What one thing you might try is to get into a van and go to Northern Ontario.
I ended up finding an amazing doctor. He was a GP. I came to him, 2008, I think. You may have heard of him, maybe not. He was called the pot doctor up here. He tried taking people off of opiates and putting them on weed or marijuana, medical marijuana, sorry. He was the only person, you know, up here that had a doctor's office that was actually taking a patient, that would take patients. Someone had said it somewhere, and I decided to walk into his office. And I said, listen, I haven't seen a doctor in a couple of years. I'm still getting these prescriptions for these things. I don't think I need these chemicals. I just want to understand what's going on, and I want to help my own self out. I've been trying to take myself off of these. And his face just dropped. I said, I need your help. I'll be your patient if you'll just take me off these and not do any more doctor stuff with me. Just help wean me off these pills. Will you do this for me? And he said, of course I will. And I went, thank you. That was it. I mean, he helped a lot because I told him, I said, you know, sometimes I kind of feel suicidal. He's like, oh no, right now. And you know, he did all the, you know, do we need to take you somewhere, whatever, you know? And I said, not now, no, but every once in a while, you know, I feel it. And I was testing him out, right? He told me, he said, well, listen, anytime you need to, there's a key hidden right over here. Let me show you. And he brought me over to it. He said, this key right here opens this door over here. Let me show you. And if you ever need to come here, you just come here instead.
Nice.
Whether I'm home, whether I'm not, whether my wife's here, whether she, no, it doesn't matter. You just come here instead. And that was it. That was, oh my gosh, there could be another human being in the world that I might actually be able to trust.
Right.
Because then all of a sudden, you know, one out of every 10 thoughts was not, I can kill myself, but I can go there.
So you found this person and it was, sounds like it was a huge, huge deal.
Yeah.
You get off the meds.
Yes.
For some reason, I feel like the relationship with the guy doesn't work out, but I could be wrong.
No, no, for sure not.
Until you started feeling and speaking more openly about your experiences, did you keep mostly keep your attempt, that overdose, kind of a secret?
100%. I would never lie, but I would never tell anybody it.
Mm.
I skirted around every attempt of anyone to even mention it. There was no way I was letting anyone know except for whoever might have already known. It was like a fear, the same type of fear as beforehand, where I came close to death, or that's what my psyche believed. Now I got to keep my mouth shut this time. I cannot open my mouth because that created more havoc than there ever could have been. So I better just keep my mouth shut. And I, you know, I'm kind of glad I did, because I don't think I have it in me to have gone to a hospital, even a 72-hour stay. I don't know how I would have handled that. I'm just so shocked at people who are able to go through that. I said no to things a lot because it was so aggravating to me already. But if I was even just a little bit more easeful, I would have been through, I think I might have gone through a lot worse. I refused to tell anybody that I had attempted. And even after my brother, I never told people that I had attempted.
Was there a period of time where you would think back to your attempt and wish, man, I wish that had worked?
Yes, but it always followed with, I wish I'd have killed my father first.
Do you feel that way now?
Yeah. So when it comes to wishes, right, and we look back on our past, I can only wish that there was help for my father. Because I know once you understand abandonment and you understand neglect and you understand, you know, how abuse works, you want that solved. What I would want is to have, you know, my mother and my father and my family together and everyone loving and happy, like on all the TV shows that we love and adore. Now, and if you say, well, you have the option of, now you go back in time, you have the option. The only option is you kill your father or you don't, and you have the chance again too. And your brother possibly lives because he doesn't get abused or whatever. There'd have to be a real specific scenario. It's just all in the imagination when it comes to our past. So because I now have understood and went into and taught myself the best I can about these two conditions that are totally overlooked, called psychopathy and narcissistic personality disorder, and try to understand these people's perspective that they've shared, the ones who are diagnosed, and share their how it is they see the world. It is so understandable why I suffered what I did with my father. It's just 100% laid out there. Mm-hmm. Yet there's nothing in our society. There's no way to do anything about it. We don't have any avenue to identify these people in our midst and say, we want to help you. They, mm-hmm. The option is, if you think that they are like this, just stay away from them. Get them out of your life. Abandon them, right? And get them out of your life. Now you don't have to worry the consequences of their actions. And you just work on you. They're off abusing other people then. It's a dynamic that has to change.
How many people can you talk to in your life and bring up possible ideations and they'd be okay with it?
I have two people who would be okay with it. Okay. I'd have lots of people that I would still talk to about it, though.
Okay.
Even though, as I think about it, many of them wouldn't be too okay with it. They'd sit and they'd listen a little bit. They'd probably offer a whole bunch of, you know, call this number or can you do this? Or, yeah, no, I didn't, though. That breakup left me absolute with no vehicle, half the income that I had, and bedridden. And I had a sick dog. I wasn't too sure what I was going to do because I didn't really have anyone that I was communicating with on a regular basis. And I was pretty sure that I might pass away before I got better because I had some health issues. I was able to find a service here for the elderly who will call you every morning and literally make sure you're alive. I contacted them and I said, listen, I don't have anybody. I'm worried that, you know, if I pass away and my animals are just stuck here, it's going to be days. And I would like this service if you wouldn't mind. And they said, oh, yes, that's not a problem. This wonderful lady, she's getting close to 80 years old, volunteers in the community. And she calls me every morning like clockwork and has a brief, pleasant conversation. We get along on everything you could possibly imagine and some things we don't. But as I build, you know, a little bit of trust here and a little bit of trust there, I did have to reach out. I had to reach out. I had to start saying, I need help here. And is there this help here? And the little bits of help that I could get like that, they mean everything. And now it's been a few years. Even if I have a bunch of people who she knows are in contact with me enough that I'm okay, she still calls me every morning. She's like, no, I'll still call you. You're still on my list.
Nice. Okay, so it's time to talk pink and purple pill. If Angela takes it, would put her to sleep quietly and peacefully, and she would not wake up, and there'd be no pain, and she would be gone, and nobody would know that it was a suicide. And so I give the guests the option to take it or save it or get rid of it. But you have a different answer, so tell me.
I would take that pill, and I would take a picture of that pill. And I would try to get as much exposure and awareness of the pill as possible. I would want every last human being in the world to understand that there is such a thing called suicide in this world, where human beings are in so much pain that they want to take their own life. And it is such a shameful act and such as this embarrassing thing, such this horrible thing that no one wants to talk to anybody about except for you and me, I guess, that this pill had to be concocted for people to feel okay to want to die. There are human beings out here who want to die so bad, and they're willing to take their own lives.
Yeah.
And no one wants to talk about it. No one wants to talk about the reasons why. No one wants to, it's just shut right out, and that there has to be this option. That, I mean, and what a beautiful option. I mean, I can take this pill. And if I want to kill myself, no one's going to know that it was suicide. So everybody's conscience is clear.
Right.
And it's all okay. It's just another death that happens like every other death in the world. And we'll get through our steps, our grieving steps, and it'll be fine. And it's not a suicide.
Right.
I would want awareness. I would want everyone to know, hey, there is such a thing as this pink and purple pill.
You'd like do it as a sacrifice almost, like a martyr.
And it's because of the fact that no one wants to deal with this thing called suicide.
Yeah, I know. Well, so few. Other specific myths or misconceptions you'd like to dispel around any of this stuff?
Yeah, that suicide is stupid.
Oh, okay.
We can take stupid actions. Yeah, I was naive and therefore stupid to think that all those pills I took would actually just do what I thought they were going to do. But I'm not stupid. And I've noticed by listening to the podcasts that I have listened to, and I haven't listened to all of them, most of your guests are really intelligent. I'm listening to them going, wait a minute. It's like, wow, maybe there's something to this. Maybe there's a reason why we do overprocess in our minds, right? Why we have the thoughts overprocessing on each other. And what's going on here with that? I decided that I was going to utilize that too for good. Not to sit here and think about how can I kill myself, but think about how or why or any of the other questions on any other thing in the world until I educate myself well enough to help this situation. Because it's a big situation and it seems overwhelming, but it seems like I've already had all the overwhelming in my life I could ever have. And if I can do, you know, 5 more things in a second than someone else mentally, right? Because it's just going. Maybe I can come up with a solution. Maybe I can work on it in my head instead of working on how do I kill myself?
When you emailed me, you sent me a link. It was a YouTube video. But in the description, in the actual email, it sounded like a few different things you're doing. So is there a way to somewhat succinctly share with me and the audience, what is this work you're involved with? Like, what is it? What's the goal kind of thing?
I decided what I already knew about the abuse cycle, I needed to dumb it down. I needed to get it right down to basics. I thought, okay, if I'm going to talk about suicide, it's going to be to adults and I'm going to need to have to talk to adults so I can, you know, discuss the limbic system and I can discuss, you know, all these fancy, wonderful things. But no, there's children who are being abused who might not understand it. They might not get it. They might not understand that if someone else is doing harm to them, that they don't have to be on the victim side. They can do something internally. So what I wrote there on my YouTube page, so I only have 2 videos on my page. One is the what you may or may not know. And that was my attempt at explaining the victim abuse cycle to possibly a child or a teenager in hopes that they might be able to comprehend that someone who's abusing you was abused and they condone the abuse, even if it's not consciously, it's subconsciously. Somewhere in them, they don't think that that's wrong. And somewhere in you, you think it's wrong. You're the one being hurt, of course. So there's a dynamic happening there and you don't have to live in that dynamic. I wanted to try and see if there's a way to convey that. And then to pull yourself out of the dynamic, make sure you aren't harming other people and then do as much help as you can. The more actions you take that are helpful, the less time you got to do harm.
Do you think you'll make it to 50?
Yeah. In fact, the psychiatrics weren't the only medical things I've endured. What I found out was when you are suffering in a household with narcissistic abuse happening, you can have physiological issues. And I was going to the doctor from as young as I can remember all the way until I realized I had to take care of my own health in my mid-40s, only a few years ago. I stopped seeing doctors altogether after removing myself from the pharmaceutical meds for the psychiatric conditions. I started having a thyroid issue. I already wasn't seeing any doctors other than that GP. I ended up having to see many doctors for my thyroid issue. And my pills again were going up and up and up and up in dose. And I was experiencing a gazillion other symptoms. Excruciating pain in many different parts of my body. There's so many times I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it through the night with this pain that I can't pinpoint. I'd rush down to the hospital. They do x-rays and they do all these things and they tell me there's nothing wrong. And I'm sweating and I'm in pain and I'm telling them, no, there's pain. There's pain right here. It's bad. And they're telling me there's nothing wrong with you. Please go home, have a bite to eat, whatever. And I was told basically my whole life as a young person. My mom would take me to the doctor and he'd just say, oh, there's nothing wrong with her, and send her home. Just give her ginger ale and crackers. She's fine. After removing myself up north, I started again seeing this doctor, and he said, well, you're going to need to do something about this. And the end option after going to the highest doses of your pills is to just remove the thyroid. And I said, I'm not having any of that. So I stopped the stressing driving to the doctor's appointments and all of the, you know, get an x-ray here and do this over there and all of that. And I started saying, okay, I'm going to have to teach myself what this body is. When you're suicidal, you can just go, okay, so what? So what if I die? Okay, this thing I'm in, it's a machine. They're all using it like a machine. I better learn what this machine is. I got to figure this out. Otherwise, I don't got nothing. And yeah, so now I believe that I have the opportunity to live to 120 in with full cognitive abilities and with all of the energy I had when I was 30. If I can repair myself enough to get to that state. And I really do believe that. So no, I'm not gonna die at 50, nor I will be here at 50 and I will be here for as long as I can after that. Yeah, I want to be here a long good time. I want to see if I can make a dent in this society.
Life Force, not the name of your memoir, I don't think, but it's not terrible. Life Force,
The Adventures of Angela.
That's what it is.
Oh yeah.
What, 7:47 p.m. Eastern, what's the rest of your evening like?
I'm probably going to listen to some more of your podcasts because I have not gotten through them all. And I'm really enjoying listening to other people's explaining what it is they went through and how they are now and all of that. It gives right. me this, I don't know, a sense of, hey, there is other people who've been through stuff. You kind of always know that, and you get it here and there. But when you get to sit with yourself and you get to listen to someone that you're not in front of, they're not, you're not looking at their facial expressions or anything. And you just get to listen, like we get to now listen to them, even though they haven't came to us to talk to us.
Right.
And I still feel that that's a good unifying thing. Like, these are my people. They know where I'm at. Even though we don't know each other, we know what's going on. You've put them together in a way. I've been on Facebook. That's the first thing I did. My brother put his note on Facebook.
Oh.
And I stopped using Facebook because it was just, we made a memorial page for him. And then my sister and I got into fighting and then she took it down. And I just said, you know what? I'm not doing Facebook anymore. And that helped. The support groups that were on there before I shut it down, it was difficult, but I was trying to find some support in the groups and it was all just this person killed themselves and now I'm in grief. And it was like, yeah, I'm in grief too, but I want to talk about why. And no one, even in like a group for people who, again, survived someone else committing suicide, were just very upset, angry. They'd even come at you with comments like, what do you mean you want to talk about it? Well, yeah, I want to talk about what that person could have been going through. And have you, anyone of you really addressed it and maybe, you know, decided to make some changes in your life? Because when they do that, there's a little bit of a disconnect from the people around them too, or they wouldn't have done it. Mostly. This is how I feel. Yeah, you have a naive hope that if you kill yourself, the people around you that caused you any pain and suffering, or they're going to change those things somehow. That's not how it works, right? It's, it's our own mental perception. It's an internal thing when you're hurting and you're hoping people might do this or might do that. So
I'm glad The Adventures of Angela is now included in this podcast, and people out there will hear you at some point in the same way that you're hearing them. Maybe even when you get off this call. I think I've asked all the questions I want to ask, but of course I want to give you an opportunity to add anything else that we didn't talk about or a question I didn't ask or anything else that comes to mind.
I really feel that getting out into the middle of the woods helped me a lot. And there's been studies coming out that say that, you know, getting out into the wilderness, getting out into nature really does the mind good. The Adventures of Angela are fun. And my newest premise is the world has ended. And now we have to learn to live in nature again. What do we bring with us? There's nothing new being manufactured. There's no money. There's nothing. The world has ended. There's just people and what is here. Now, what do we do? How do we get back to nature? So, yeah, so I've been working on that premise, and I've been out here on some crown lands doing some natural building, some natural water harvesting, some plant identification and whatnot like that. And it is, I don't know, rewarding. I mean, you feel really good to start to know things around you and start to see how nature works. You can learn these things in school, but when you're just out in the woods by a river for a day and a half and you're observing, it's a whole nother ball of wax. And when you have an overactive mind like mine, going on all sorts of things, it seems to clarify and point me into directions that I need to go and all sorts of things. When, like I say, sitting in the middle of town to do this interview just didn't seem like the right thing to do. I needed to have some woods around me. So I think that would help. And I think that if there was that option, like the option I had to go to my doctor's where he showed me the key, if there was the option for people who wanted to kill themselves and they said, listen, I want to kill myself. I need away from my life and I need somewhere to go. Right now we have, you know, addicts and homeless and a lot of people that are hurting sorely bad who need places to go to. We have a hard time helping people in this society. So I feel that I need to try and create places in nature that people can come to and not be afraid to be in nature, but allow themselves to de-stress if that's how they can do it. Because I know a lot of people say, wow, I would love to just go out in the middle of nature. No, not even cell phone service, as you can tell. Places where people could go, be comfortable and enjoy nature for a bit. I also believe in something some people may not really like what I have to say. Here in Ontario, we have a pill, a suicide assist pill. People can make the argument to take this pill, to have the doctor administer it, to have a date and time set with your family and your loved ones. Just be done with this place, regardless of the reason. I think that should actually be available to people. I know some people won't like that. They'll say, but wait a minute, you are going to kill yourself. And if you'd have done that, you'd be gone. And then where would you be? But those who really want to die shouldn't have to go through the steps we have to try and go through to try and kill ourselves. It shouldn't be that way. To give the person an out from their life first while still living. Somewhere, anywhere, some way, somehow, some type of program, something where they say, okay, you don't want to live this life? Okay. But how about we just move you physically and remove the stressors from your life that are external for a time and see and have someone to talk to, literally, very simple. And then work on a plan. If the person says, listen, I'm out here. I've been out here for a week. I got away from my life, but I am dead serious. I've worked it all through. These are all my reasons. Yada, yada, yada. I don't want to live anymore. And again, if they're over the age of 25, which is, and I would even push it to 30 because the limbic brain is not fully developed until the age of 25 and possibly all the way to the age of 30. So if the thing that is doing all that thinking is not even fully developed, if you know, how can you throw a ball without a fully developed arm? You know, how can you logically think without a fully developed brain? If the person's at that age or older and they've logically thought it through and they've given themselves an out or two and they want to go, I think a GP should be ready and willing to set up that date, you know, with a psychologist, yada, yada. I mean, there has to be some regulations. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't like these words. There has to be, you know, human beings in place to say, listen, okay, you want to kill yourself. Okay. Not, oh no, you want to kill yourself. I get that. Now, what can we do? Can we see what we can do? Where are you at? What kind of knowledge do you have about what's going on? Do you have a why? And see if you can work on it with the person straight up, like human beings. And then if they want to go, yeah, I believe in, hey, let's get this person help to go. No joke. You know, there's a pill, there's a time. They say, hey, yeah, I'm ready. I'm going to tell my mom. I'm going to tell my so-and-so. I'm going to tell my partner. I'm going to tell my children. Be at this place at this time. This is the day I'm dying, period. Now, then you got, you know, you got your weeks or two or three or whatever the time is to deal with any kind of issues that come up with that. But your decision is your decision. And if you still want it on that day, I don't see why anyone should have to continue to suffer. But no, not too many people are going to want to do that because of all of that backlash that comes from those other human beings. That's why we all do it in secret. So no, I think that the condition of it is serious enough. That's how, you know, hey, everyone, this is what's going on with me. There's no help for me. I feel this way. I'm going to take a pill because, again, we have this pill and apparently it is painless and you do slip off. I'm just saying, if it exists, and that's the most preferable way to go, and people who want to go are still stuck doing unimaginable things to try and go, this, again, is an issue. It's a societal red flag.
It's a good project. I wish you all good things. Well, thanks for talking.
Hey, man. Thank you so much. It's been a great talk. And I really do appreciate that you've done this.
You're very welcome. I hope the rest of your night is, as I say, not sucking.
I hope you have a wonderful night.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
As always, thanks so much for listening and all of your support. Special thanks to Angela up in Ontario. Thanks, Angela. If you are a suicide attempt survivor and you'd like to talk, please reach out. Hello at suicidenoted.com on Facebook or X at suicidenoted. And you can check the show notes to learn more about this podcast, including our membership. And that is all for episode number 230. Stay strong. Do the best you can. I'll talk to you soon.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.